So it's been intense. But, well, that's kind of the way I was trained. Always intense, stretch it, and then take whatever you find useful, of course. But I want to go over at least bodhicitta a little bit, so we get back to, you know, what is bodhicitta, what does it mean? And of course, we've heard already, it's very advanced, but there's no problem with advanced. You just kind of put the stake very high and then do what you can. That's kind of the idea. So it's a consciousness, it's a type of mind. Pardon? Oh, I'm so confused this morning. Okay, sorry. We need to do the prayers first. Okay, yes, thank you for telling me. Let's do the prayers first before we start talking. Sogi chon. Okay, now. All right. So, just to say a few words about bodhicitta again, to summarize. So, it's a state of mind, it's a kind of awareness, a mental consciousness, which can only arise through habituation, through familiarity. It is the door to the Mahayana, it's the entryway to the Mahayana. What else? It's special. It comes along with an aspiration that wants to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's like a type of mind that basically wishes to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Okay, so that part is clear. But it's very easy to confuse bodhicitta with just an ordinary mind thinking, just thinking, oh, may I be enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. We can do that. It's very easy to just think that. But it needs to come from deep within, and it needs to come from the wish to really benefit others. So there are the two components of bodhicitta, the two limbs, as they're called. That there are two types of wishes, actually, that you have. And to become enlightened is only the means to fulfill the first wish. So the example, you remember, if you wish for water, that's your main wish. You want to get water. You want to drink water. And in order to be able to do so, you wish to have a cup. So the secondary wish is to have the cup, because that allows you to fulfill your first wish. Right? Or we took a more common day example, you want to go shopping and you want to buy things in the supermarket. So that's your main intention. And to get there, in order to get there, you then wish to take the car, or you wish for someone to take you there. That is the secondary aspiration, in order to be able to fulfill the first aspiration. So likewise, the benefit of others, that is the main aspiration. Others' enlightenment. Others' enlightenment is your main aspiration. But in order to get there realistically, you need to become enlightened first. And this is realistic, because if we really want to lead someone to a certain state, we need to get there first. It makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, in everyday kind of life, if we have a disease and someone else has a disease, and if the disease does not enable us to do the things we could ordinarily do, then we need to get better before we can have others to get better. That's kind of the idea. And of course, we also know what to do. If we've been able to get out of that problem, out of that disease, we know how to get there ourselves. That's just from a daily kind of, let's say, kind of a common sense kind of explanation. Like in day-to-day life, that's how it usually works. But on top of that, omniscience is, of course, the factor that is so important. So it's not just because we went there ourselves, we know how to get there. It's not just, you know, when we're free of all these problems, then we can really be of benefit to others. But it's also, moreover, as a Buddha, one is omniscient and therefore able to help anyone by telling them exactly what they should do. There's no way in which we can remove sentient being suffering. So this is how it's different from maybe other traditions. We cannot actually remove someone's suffering. I mean, remove someone's suffering, it's a little tricky, because then we could say, well, a dentist couldn't help someone to take out that painful tooth. Of course, a little we can do. We can do a little. We can just console someone. We can help in the moment, make them feel better. But the real root of what makes them suffer, the actual root cause, we cannot remove. We can only tell people, well, what they should do to feel better. Does that make sense? So we can do a little bit, of course, and we should by all means. So this was also the discussion that came up. It's all sounds like it's so far ahead. It's also far ahead. So can we do anything now? Does it have anything right now? Of course, there's so much we can do right now. So keeping that in mind, one day I would like to be this special being. Whether it's possible needs to be seen. We don't even know that. But keeping that as like a far ahead goal, and then doing the best one can in the moment. I think that's really important. Yeah. So there's already more happiness doing this, being more altruistic and being kinder and being more open towards other people's suffering. We suffer less. That's already the reward we get right now. And of course, that allows us to continue and do more. And as we do today, the different types of the two techniques of bodhicitta, it becomes even clearer. Until we've done that, it's not clear enough, I think. But anyway, so these are the two components. So you wish to become enlightened, but because you really wish to benefit others in the best way. And having explained that, this definition, and some parts of the definition are not that important, mind, mental factor. For now, you don't need to worry about it too much. Most important are the two components, yes? The two components, full stop. Okay, is shamatha a prerequisite for bodhicitta? Some say yes, some say no. I don't know. It's hard to say. It depends on how you define bodhicitta, I guess. The way it's defined in the text that I studied, it says it's not necessary. Right? But there's other texts. As far as I know, the text they use at Sarah J, they say shamatha is necessary. So they just define it slightly differently. Right? So in the end, it doesn't matter whether you define it that way or you don't define it that way. If you define bodhicitta the way in the Jebun Rosaling textbooks, for example, that's one of the monastic institutions, right? The way it's defined there, then even without shamatha, you can generate bodhicitta. But then, in order to move on, you need to develop shamatha. Otherwise, you can't move on. Shamatha means like calm abiding, the ability to stay on one object for at least 4 hours, special concentrated mind. So bodhicitta is only the beginning. Then to really practice and develop the mind, we need to develop very intense states of concentration. So that's shamatha. So shamatha is then developed afterwards. But some have already before shamatha, so it's no problem. According to the Sarah J scriptures, no, you need to have shamatha too. So then what is initially called bodhicitta in the Jebun Rosaling system, they wouldn't call bodhicitta. But in the end, it doesn't make any difference. It's just a matter of definition. Does that make sense? You still progress in the same way. You may call a person with bodhisattva earlier than the other tradition would. But it doesn't matter. What you need to do is still the same. So it's just a matter of applying names. These are just names. Whether you call someone bodhisattva or not, if they have that intense wish, they're moving towards enlightenment, unless that wish degenerates. Does that make sense? Yes, but I mean, let's say you have this wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings already now. According to the Sirajya system, you're not a bodhisattva yet, if you don't have shamatha yet. According to the Buddhism system, you are. Are you any better or worse? No, you're still the same. Do you still have to generate shamatha? Definitely. You need that to progress. So, you know, one would say you are, the other one would say you're not, but you're still the same person, you have the same quality. Do you need to develop shamatha? Yes, you do. So, just continue. Yeah? So in that way, yes. Absolutely. Ultimate bodhicitta, which will be explained later, that is like later on. It's not just that you have bodhicitta, you also realize emptiness directly. At that time, of course. Yeah. Bodhicitta is only from the Mahayana point of view. If you're now moving towards Buddhahood, when do you really start moving towards Buddhahood? Once you have bodhicitta, the wish to really go there. Right? I mean, this is like in everyday life, the same thing. When we have the wish to do something, real wish, the intention to really do it, and we start engaging, doing the things that are necessary to get there, well, then we're really on the way. And then you progress from there. And of course it gets better and better. The bodhicitta gets stronger. One's understanding of reality gets better. And shamatha, of course, comes in there very soon. But it'll be explained a little later down. Okay. Anyway, so this was a little more advanced, but taking us back to, well, bodhicitta, the causes, the conditions, what are responsible. So, of course, we need to look at the causes to really understand what it is. And again, it's something we could, I mean, there's the intellectual side. We should think about this. We should reflect on that to get an overall sense what this is all about. To understand Buddhism, if we don't have like a bit of a map, we can easily go astray and misunderstand things. And I'd stress this over and over that many of the teachings we receive are just adding pieces of the puzzle. There's great emphasis on laying out the framework, laying that out. And at first, there's just details here and there, and it seems all confusing. But something happens to the mind. You have already a rough map. And then you hear it again, you get a little bit a clearer map, and you get a clearer map. So there's a lot of repetition. So for some of you, this is new, this is not a repetition, this is like, wow, what's going on? But it's just laying out that foundation. And then the next time you hear it, it gets easier, it gets easier. So many teachings of the Dalai Lama, the same people come again and again and again, and they're very similar often. But there's also a trick in which you listen to the teachings, you listen with the heart. So you complete the picture more and more, but at the same time you listen with the heart, like, how does this affect me personally? How is that relevant to me in my everyday life? For example, if it says, as the causes, having an excellent lineage, such a weird way of saying it, that's just the ancient language, but what it's saying is basically having a disposition or affinity with an interest in practicing the Mahayana teachings. Well, do I have that? You know, to be honest enough, do I have that interest? And am I doing anything to further that interest? Am I just saying, oh, I really like Mahayana, but I never listen to teachings, I never read books. Is that enough or not? Then, do I rely on a properly qualified teacher? As I said before, you don't have to be physically close to a properly qualified teacher, because these highly advanced teachers, I mean, we don't need to be physically close. It's a mental, it's a state of mind to tuck into them, to tuck into their ability and communicate on a mental level. I mean, there's really, like, I've talked to so many people who said to me, I've communicated with my Lama and then I found the answer. Maybe that's just all bullshit, but if it works, let's try it. Okay. I don't know. I mean, it's there's nothing scientific that tells us it works. But, you know, either there are a lot of coincidences Or there's really something to it, so might as well try. And of course, listen to their advice. If there's some lama, and I'm talking about real lamas, high lamas, if there's someone who really affects you deeply, the way they speak, well, listen to them by all means. Right? Okay. And then, important, do not be disheartened by the difficulties and problems of samsara. That's very difficult. We have a tendency to be disheartened. We turn around and run away, right? We find it very difficult to face problems and difficulties. But to stop in our track and think, okay, let's face this problem. Let's face it with calm, with wisdom, with intelligence, with compassion. Whoever causes the problem, let's consider them. And before you know, a problem that seems unsolvable, suddenly things start falling into place, and it's not that impossible anymore. So that's something, this courage. You need courage and determination. That's really important. So some of the greatest practitioners, they have incredible courage. Bring it on, never mind. Right? It's okay, I can face it. Yeah. And so far, I mean, you've always been able to face difficulties, you're still here. So it should give us some self-confidence. I mean, you have all your own share of problems and difficulties, I'm sure. Right? I mean, if I think, oh my God, I went through so much. But then when I listen to other people, I go, oh wow, this is nothing. Yeah? Okay. And of course, when we practice Dharma, it's in the nature of that, that problems arise. Right? Difficulties, obstacles arise. They need to be removed. So sometimes when one starts Dharma practice, it's worse in the beginning. Yeah? But when one keeps calm and just keeps doing it, and not doubt too much, or doubt too much as in like, ah, oh, what is going on? And again, I have all these problems, and I'm not a good person. It just happens to me. No, no, no. Just let go. Just face it. Okay. What is the intelligent way to remove this? This is just part of it. More obstacles arise. I'm thinking of, like, sometimes, you know, like these medicine, the special medicine, like herbal medicine or Ayurvedic and this kind of medicine. Sometimes when you start taking it, the symptoms are intensified. Homeopathic, yeah, homeopathic medicine. So it's a bit like that. So when we know that, we don't really worry. Oh, suddenly I get sicker. Oh my God, this medicine is not working. No, 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 no. It does that. It intensifies the symptoms. Do we have an exact reason for why this happens? I don't think so. I'm not sure there's an exact reason. But it's just like that. When we know it, we can face it. So with Dharma practice, it's the same. When we start first Dharma practice, more obstacles may arise. Okay, when we know that, then that's just normal, never mind. Okay, so these are the first four causes. So does that concern you? Well, yeah, it does. In a way, we can all find something with here that concerns us. And then they're called the four conditions. So in the whole kind of like academic, or if you like the whole explanation of Buddhism, what bodhicitta is and all the different details, well, it says that just that is not enough, but it's still a good condition, a good cause. I mean, there's four conditions here. It's not that they are sufficient, because if you just generate the wish to become enlightened for the reason that is mentioned here, well, that's not for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's not enough. But still, that in itself, plus wishing for the benefit of sentient beings, is great. Okay, so the first one you've already seen, which is having directly seen for oneself the outstanding abilities and powers of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other higher realized beings, or having heard from them from a reliable person one aspires to develop the same extraordinary qualities. So that's the beauty of meeting some of the lamas. And again, this seems like really weird when I tell you these stories, and I don't have time to tell you a lot of stories, but boy, some of the stuff I experienced myself in Dharamsala with some of these lamas, it can't have been a coincidence. I mean, first of all, they're clairvoyant powers. And many of you have heard these stories of people, you know, they get very sick. They then, Gila in Dharamsala, who lives in Dharamsala, many of you know her, she goes to see one of the very high lamas, Jadu Rinpoche. He tells the person, do such and such and such and such. It often goes against the advice of the doctor. I mean, they still seek treatment, but, you know, it may be about changing the doctor or doing such and such. And everyone is like, oh, no, don't do it, don't do it. But the person continues doing it. Now she's fine. So many stories like that. There's a story. I personally had a few stories. A story of a lady who had cancer, a friend of my mom's. I went to see one of my teachers, Kitty Tendzin Rinpoche. Of course, he was in Israel. Kitty Tendzin Rinpoche, so incredible lama, unbelievable, incredible clairvoyance and wisdom and kindness, unbelievable. He passed away some years ago. He was diagnosed with cancer in Haifa when it was bombed. He was in the bomb shelter after he was diagnosed. He was like, great, I'm dying, an opportunity to practice. Right? I mean, for them, death is just an intermediate changing clothes kind of situation. Okay. So, and I asked him about this lady, and he said, no, can do something. You know, she should continue treatment, of course, continue doing what she's doing, but there's certain rituals we can do, she get better. Okay. We did the ritual. She went to the doctor. They did the check again. It was gone. The liver cancer was gone. Doctors were like, it must have been a mistake. I don't know. Before it was there, now it's not there. Well, in the end, they couldn't figure it out, and everyone's happy, and she went home. And that was for maybe 4 or 5 years. She was free of cancer. Very happy. Oh, she loved Kitty Tendzin Rinpoche after that. She's not a Buddhist, but yeah, after that, she felt very close to him. And then she was diagnosed with cancer again. So it came back. I went again to see Rinpoche, and Rinpoche said, this time I cannot do anything. This time the karma is so strong, there's nothing I can do. The first time there was another karma that could be invoked, and he knew that. And he was able to help her. The second time, she died. Yeah. But he made sure she died peacefully, like pujas were done, so that she would have an easy passing on. So, yeah. And there are lots of other stories. Lots of other stories. Visa stories. I had to get a visa from Nepal. I wanted to go to Nepal. I went to see Kitty Tendzin Rinpoche before, many years ago. And I asked him, should I go I would like to get this visa. And he said, if you want to go, you go tonight. I'm like, no, Rinpoche, I don't want to go. You go tonight. You want to get the visa? You go tonight. That's it. Out of question. I said, okay. I got into this hot, hot bus. Take the hot, hot trip. You know, it was horrible. In May, over the plains of India. I got to Nepal. I got my visa. And he had told me, return to India right away. And I did. And the moment I'm back in India, Rajiv Gandhi gets assassinated. Borders closed. Visas cancelled. I was one of the last people who got a student visa. And you still can't get a student visa in Nepal. So Rinpoche, really amazing. And don't think it had anything to do with the assassination. You know, people might think, oh, he knew. Anyway, so there are many stories like that. So many unbelievable stories. So that really inspires us. They're these special beings. I mean, they really have special abilities. Where do these special abilities come from? We all have the potential for those, but we haven't actualized them yet because we're so narrow-minded. We're so, you know, focused on I, me, and mine. I mean, it's not saying we're not good people. We can't help it. It's just we don't perceive the I in the way it really exists, so that's the natural reaction. But we're not doing ourselves a favor. And these beings have gone beyond such that they open their mind to others. And when we do this, there's more of a perceptiveness. I mean, just in everyday life, if we open our mind more to others, we become a lot more perceptive. We wouldn't call that clairvoyance, right? Become a lot more perceptive. We just see more things. And then these great beings, they develop it further and further and perceive more. And that's when we call it clairvoyance. They just can see things. Our mind has the ability to do so. But we have these, I don't know what you call this, the horses wear them sometimes. Scheuklappen, I don't know. Again, it's just the German word that comes to mind. Does anyone know the word for those things? Never mind. These things, you know, like, I have to look it up. We wear those. And so, Scheuklappen. Okay, so Scheuklappen it is. Very useful German word, you know. Okay, never mind. Okay, did you have a question?
So what really happened there? It's an external help, so because we learned a little bit.
Oh, wait. Benny, good question. We are the only ones who can help ourselves. Well, how about going to a doctor and getting the right kind of prescription. No, that's true. But she gave an offering. She gave an offering. Like the way it works, I mean, also if I just connect, I mean, just making a prayer for a person, you connect with that person. And because we're interdependent, it's not that we're totally independent entities and that nothing can affect us. I mean, someone talking to us, can affect our mood, can help us to overcome a problem. In the end, we need to do it ourselves. We need to, in the end, like, for example, with the medicine, we need to take it ourselves. And so in her case, she needed to have the karma to get better. So that was activated through external forces. I mean, sometimes a karma can be activated by someone else, right? I mean, if you have the karma to die in an airplane crash, you need an airplane and you need a pilot. Maybe the pilot screws up or the plane breaks down, but there's always some cause there. So these causes and conditions, they interact with one another. There's this interdependence. We're dependent on everything else around us. So if you don't have the karma to die in an airplane crash, well, you're going to survive, no matter everyone else doesn't, right? And you may not be hurt at all. But if you do have the karma, you still need the external that affects that. So my karma being, having that karma, being in that situation, right? Then this is how the karma. I mean, it is very complicated. It's a very complicated issue, the whole karma issue. It's very difficult to understand. And I don't want to go into too many details because even the Buddha said, don't go into too much. It just gives you a headache. To understand the very subtle working, I mean, even scientifically, we don't know. Like a sprout, what is exactly the seed, what exactly led to the sprout. We cannot tell all these little molecules and so forth. It's too complicated. Likewise with karma. It's just a law of cause and effect. So, but the point is, the prayers that they did for her, it still could, because they did it for her specifically, so they established a relationship. And what you should do from your own side is make an offering. It doesn't matter the amount. The amount is not important, but you give something from your side. So there's a giving and taking. Yeah. So therefore, oftentimes when you ask for a ritual to be done, you make an offering. Sometimes that's not possible. The person is too sick or they don't know about it. But oftentimes those who know make an offering. And then it's kind of like a giving-taking kind of situation. And again, it's not about the money, about the amount. It's just the giving. I mean, of course, the more you give, the better it is, because you practice generosity, yeah? So it's just the law of karma. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, of course. She was aware. So it could have helped her, right? It could have helped her. But the second time, she was also aware. And the second time, it didn't. So I didn't tell her. Second time, she was very scared of dying. So I didn't tell her right away, you know, that she was, this time he couldn't do anything. I had to tell her very gently while I was in Germany. So the second time she thought again she would get better. I just told her, the first time I told her, because I wasn't sure, you know, so I told her, Rinpoche did a mo, he said, this will help. Okay, that was it. And so she did, she you know, made an offering for the puja to be done, and that was it. And then she got better. Yeah. So there was no promise in the beginning. The second time, again, I said, this will help, which was true. It helped her to die peacefully. Rinpoche had told me personally, this time she won't survive. So then when I got back to Germany, she was not getting better. And I told her, yes, Rinpoche said, this time it's difficult. So, you know, you may have to get ready. You have to get prepared. And so we talked about this. And she was still scared what to do. But in the end, she died peacefully. Yeah, so it's not just the psychology, because she wasn't, I wasn't sure. Remember, she could cure her. I was like, I can't tell a woman she's going to get better, and if she doesn't, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't ask. She didn't discuss this with me. It was a very difficult time when phone was very difficult, so I was not in Germany. I don't know. This I don't know. She may have. My mom was friends with her. I would have to ask my mom. Okay. Yes. Yeah, they oftentimes know what karmic seeds may ripen in someone's continuum. Yeah. But let's, okay, last question. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay, it says that directly here. It says that in the Tibetan text too. Has directly seen in the sense like you don't just hear from someone else about it. It's like you meet a person and then they tell you something to the face and like, wow, how could they know that? In that sense. You're not like, ich. Yeah, it's you use sometimes in Tibetan too, in the everyday kind of way. Instead of hearing from someone else, you see it with your own eyes, the effect someone has on you. Yeah, simple. Yeah, maybe I think you're right. I'm glad you're pointing this out. Maybe I should change the language just that people don't get too confused. Hear directly doesn't mean direct realization, as opposed to in person. Yeah, in person would be better. Seeing in person for oneself. So seeing the that would be better. In Tibetan, the same confusion can arise, but since the term in everyday life is also used directly seen, so people don't necessarily get confused. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the second point is then, even though one may have seen or heard about such inconceivable qualities, may not have seen. So in the first case, one may have seen or may have encountered some of these incredible beings and be directly inspired. But even if that doesn't take place, one studies and listens extensively to teachings that describe this enlightenment, and in dependence on these teachings, one then generate faith and admiration and aspires to attain the same state. So without having met someone who seems really special and does special things, of whom we assume to have these special abilities and therefore we're inspired, here we haven't met someone, but we read a lot, we hear, we study about this, and we go, wow, this is an incredible state, I want that. Yeah. So it's not to do with for the benefit of all sentient beings, but if you then have the wish to benefit all sentient beings, plus that's great. Makes it even better. But those themselves are not sufficient. But it does say it's good, it's helpful to have this. So to be inspired is good. To be around these beings or to be in their presence. I mean, you know, like listening to teachings or something. I mean, sometimes many different ways can inspire you just from a person. If you can be around them physically, like maybe go to Dharamsala or to India to receive teachings directly. Khajan Rinpoche was just here. He's one of those other incredible lamas. And here, wherever I go, Khajan Rinpoche follows me. I was just in the US, there was a woman, I'm just going to do this retreat with Khajan Rinpoche in Arizona. And then I meet someone else. Oh, Khajan Rinpoche is mine. It's like wherever I go, someone tells me about Khajan Rinpoche. The last retreat, a lady talked with me about Khajan Rinpoche. So, I guess I have a karmic connection with him because he keeps following me. People give me material. You have a CD from him now. I haven't listened to it yet. I want to when I'm home and I have more time. So I think, whoa, who's this? I'm getting more and more, wow, who's this Lama? And he's come to Israel on numerous occasions, so very special. So you can go to those teachings and be inspired. He's definitely very special. I have no doubt about it. Okay, but then also just hearing about it, studying, listening to teachings and being inspired in this way. And even if one has not studied or listened to those teachings, number three, one becomes aware that the Mahayana teachings are disappearing from this world. They actually are. Buddhism is disappearing. You know, I'm thinking it's really going down. Unfortunately, it's not the Chinese only. There's, of course, the Chinese destruction, but it's also the modern world, the distractions of the modern world. People have less time. Well, in a way, they have more time because everything is much faster now. But now everyone is busy with the internet and TV and, you know, there's so many distractions, more than ever. And when we have really nothing to do, we start surfing the internet and are busy for hours. So easy to get caught up in that. So, therefore, the Mahayana teachings, I mean, practitioners, it's getting more and more rare. And so these are always going to be times like that. I mean, there are times when it goes down and there are times when it goes up again. So we need to not be too negative about it. But yes. Well, it is true. That factor is true. It's thriving in the West. But honestly, the level of study here, I mean, this is what I'm trying to do here. Introduce, and this is easy. For a Tibetan student, this is very easy material. And here we're struggling. It's still in the initial phase. It's still in the baby phase. Yeah, I mean, and we're trying so hard to bring it, to make all this available, right? It's just always have these feel good kind of like, oh, a little bit compassionate, let us make feel good. It's that's not enough Buddhism, right? I mean, it is important and it's beautiful, but let's go a little bit further. Do the other things too, that's wonderful, but to introduce the entire teachings, there's so much, it's so vast, right? So we're only at the beginning there. And how many people are interested? Come on, how many people are really interested? I don't know any German person in my neighborhood. In Israel, it's much better. Israel's a lot more interested. America, Israel, and Australia, and France. Those are the four countries. But the rest of the world? I mean, there are countries where Buddhism, no Lama is in those countries. There's no one who's interested. So in terms of numbers, it's still very small. Ah, Sweden. Okay, interesting. Oh yeah, right, there you go. In Sweden, there's great interest. But like, honestly, Germany? Oh, very difficult in Germany. Yeah? So, you see what I'm saying? So, therefore, in the great practitioners, the monks and nuns, before there were so many monks and nuns, so many wanted to do retreat. Now, retreat? You know, some months, sometimes. But they don't have places to go. It's very difficult. Dharamsala, you know, India, is, Tibet is very difficult. The Chinese are very holding a strong, you know. So, it's there was really some degeneration. There are no new monks and nuns arriving in India. Because the Chinese now really stop people from coming. Before, they would escape. You could escape over the mountains. But now they have cameras everywhere. So these escape routes where you could slip through, you can't slip through anymore. There's high technology, I mean very advanced technologies, like everywhere on the checkpoints. You just can't slip through. There are self-shooting machines where you shoot yourself, basically, because you trigger something and you get shot, or you get captured very easily. It's really changed. So there are monks and nuns. They don't have enough monks and nuns anymore. In India, it's a problem right now. The monasteries, they have no newcomers. Yeah. So it's difficult. These are difficult times. We need to be aware. But instead of getting depressed about it, feel, wow, I really need to do something. I need to preserve this. I need to do something. I'm partly responsible. If I practice, I preserve the Dharma. No, it was written long. I mean, well, this was not written too long ago, a few months ago. I mean, I put this together. But you're right, the material that's actually in here, of course, is very ancient. Yes, it's very ancient, and it's hard to understand. Pardon? Can you say it again? Just acoustically, I couldn't hear you. Not just now. No. Of course, it's been ever since the Buddha was there, there's been a decline. Of course, we can look back. There's been a slow decline. And that's everywhere with most religions. There's always a decline at some point. It'll become stronger again, of course, at some point. But right now, it's a degenerative time. And so, for us, it's like, wow, I need to do something. So it doesn't get me depressed. It's just what it is. It's a permanence. Things come together, things separate again. But so to have that determination. And that's why I'm determined to bring all this to Israel, because there is this incredible potential. Israelis are very quick at getting this. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't. Oh, I think you'd be surprised. The questions, not everyone, but the questions people ask after a very short time, they're very deep. Yeah, so there's this culture. It's just something to do with Israeli culture, with Jewish culture in general. Right, I believe because of that analysis. I mean, look at Judaism. You have that questioning, you know, and it's part of the culture now, I think, and also great emphasis on education. Yeah, so these different factors, emphasis on education. So it's very helpful for learning this. Okay. So number three, then, even though one may not be aware of the degeneration of the Dharma, one recognizes that sentient beings are increasingly dominated by ignorance, competitiveness, greed, and so forth. Therefore, since it's becoming quite rare for anyone to aspire even to self-liberation, let alone complete enlightenment, one generates bodhicitta to set an example and inspire others to engage in Mahayana practice. Right? It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it's not like the doom theory. I don't want to talk doom. Do you understand doom? Like this kind of like, oh, it's all negative. No, sure, there's some negativity, but I can do something. It should give us more courage. And even if we practice just for that reason, that's great. But of course, that's incomplete. It should really be for the benefit of others. So it seems to benefit others, but not in the sense I want to take everyone to enlightenment. That is still not necessarily contained in those four conditions. But you can see how those four can be helpful. And they kind of exclude one another. The first, the second, the third. So if you don't have the first, then da-da. If you don't have the first and the second, then da-da. So then the wish to become enlightened that merely arises in dependence on one of those two, the first two, is not based on great love and compassion for all sentient beings. But it's basically based on faith and admiration. Right? And that's also great, this kind of faith, admiration, joyous faith. Yeah. And if one relies only on the third condition, so even only the third one, one finds it unbearable that the method which sentient beings use to attain freedom will soon be lost. So it doesn't really concern sentient beings' enlightenment, but more the disappearance of the Dharma. That's one's concern. Yeah, but still, that's great, but not enough. Just to point that out. And then regarding the reliance on the fourth condition, one's aspiration to become enlightened arises from the wish for sentient beings to enter the Mahayana path because of the rarity of the teachings. Yeah, it's pretty rare. Yeah. I mean, again, we discussed this yesterday. How many people come to this retreat and how many people in Israel, when they knew about this, would think, what are these people doing? Right? Yeah. Okay. So, the fourth strength. Now, those are like different conditions that help. And then there are the four strengths. So, let's see. There's some interesting things in here. One's own strength. Okay. Aspiring to attain enlightenment, independence on reflecting on the numerous types of suffering of a sentient being's experience without directly observing any of these sufferings. Okay? So without observing, of course, a little bit we observe. But let's say I reflect on the suffering that people go through in Darfur. Okay, it's become very quiet now, but for years, you may remember, you know, the suffering in Darfur. So, we may actually travel there. Go there and see directly what people are going through. Or, we may sit down, make an effort, and try to think, what is it like? The little facts that we do know, imagine, what would that be like? What would that be like? What do people go through? To really take time and reflect on that, right? That is one's own strength. Yeah.
It's not only about the other suffering. What about himself?
Okay. It doesn't mean that it's not mentioned here. It's here. One's own suffering is always through one's own.
It's not one of the best, right?
No. From the point of view of thinking of other suffering, of course you start off, and I will say this a little bit later on, without reflecting on one's own suffering, you cannot reflect on other suffering. But assuming you've done that, right? This is just for bodhicitta, which was just said, for bodhicitta, because you want to generate the wish for others to be free from suffering. Of course, you can only do that when you want to be free from suffering yourself. But like not considering that right now. We're just looking at bodhicitta as the wish for others to be free from suffering. In other words, to become enlightened. So how can we do this? We really need to understand what sentient beings go through. And they may have a lot more suffering than myself. So after I've reflected on my own suffering, my own predicament, I focus on others now. So focusing on others, there's two ways in which I figure it out myself. I try to go, you know, visualize and understand and really put myself in that situation. Or I go there directly. Okay? So the other strength with aspiring to attain enlightenment, that's the second one, through the aspiration one receives upon directly observing sentient being sufferings. Yeah. Of course, you include. I will mention that later. Absolutely, absolutely. Like, without myself understanding my own predicament. And I think I mentioned that before, didn't I? Like, you see, right now, I don't have compassion, me. Or let's say, okay, my compassion is, but I mean, we need to talk about this later. This is not the time, sorry. It'll come up later. I'm glad you bring it up. Please don't forget, if I don't answer your question, say it again. I'll talk about this when we come to compassion. But right now, we're just looking in general at the causes, right? So, what do you think is more effective? What do you think is more, not just more effective, but what is better, in other words? The first one or the second one? Okay, you say the first. Why do you think the first? It's deeper because you don't have to depend on outer factors. You make a greater effort. Yeah, I mean, I know that it's if we make the same effort in both cases, then the second one would be more effective, right? If we make the same effort. But if you want to get the same level of understanding of suffering, you have to make a greater effort in the first case. And whenever there's greater effort, there's a deeper understanding, right? I mean, if I really put myself into another person's shoes, you see, like, if I'm with another person, there's two possibilities. I know roughly a little bit about their situation in both cases. In one case, I tell them, ask them to explain me exactly what they went through. Okay? So I can get a really good sense of what they went through. Or I use my wisdom, my intelligence, and understand, use inference, use inferential understanding, what they must be going through, what they must be going through. So I use my intelligence in a much deeper sense. I really need to figure it out myself. This also refers to other things. You know, like if there's a question you have, instead of asking it and getting the answer, you try yourself to get to the answer. What is more effective? The one where you use the mind more intensely. Yeah, it's just you make the mind more flexible. You stretch it more. So anything that involves your own kind of input, the greater that is, the better it is. But of course, it's not saying we should not do. It's not like generalizing here, so please don't get me wrong. There are times when we need to get in touch with other suffering, especially initially. Especially initially, we should go to those places. We should really get a sense of it. Otherwise, we fool ourselves thinking, yeah, I understood, but we don't. And only when we go to those places can we really, the way it touches us, we feel, wow, right? So it's just saying, in general, when you use your intelligence more, it's better, but we need to be realistic. Can we do it to the same extent without actually going to perceive people's suffering? So I would recommend definitely initially to go to those places, talk to people, really try to understand it. Yes. To help in a hospital, for example, like there are people who volunteer, maybe look after, you know, a child that has cancer or something or whatever. So doing those things would be definitely something. But I'm just saying in general, you know, so it is not saying let's just all sit at home and just do that. That can be an excuse. And in the end, we don't really do anything. It's too comfortable. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Get touched. It's beautiful. I need to add that. Actually, that's very beautiful what Leora just said. I actually want to add that. That's beautiful. It's true. Because when we think about it, we really give it a lot of thought. Then when we see it, it really goes right to the heart. Whereas at other times, you're like, oh, just another one of those, you know, sufferers. Oh, I need to get an ice cream or something. You're right. Yeah, that's a very good point. I like that. Great. Okay. Then number three is strength of the cause. Strength of the cause. Aspiring to attain enlightenment, independence, and having meditated on bodhicitta in previous lives. Okay. Now that seems a bit like, well, how do I know? But of course, you know, it's like even within this life, if you've meditated on bodhicitta, let's say 10 years ago, whatever you hear now has a different effect. So habituation, It's just that, you know. And the tendency, yes. Where's the lady who said she knew a lot of people who were very kind-hearted and very... Oh, that's you. It is you. I'm sorry. I didn't recognize you. You were too far away. I couldn't see that one. Okay. So I'm thinking of those people, you know, like the people that you mentioned. I'm thinking that these are probably people who have these tendencies from a previous life. Could be that they have this kind of, you know, they were born with this. I mean, sometimes children, we look at like even twins. One twin enjoys killing ants. That would be me. And the other one had an obsession with killing ants. And then the other one enjoys, you know, saving them. Yes, yeah, saving them, exactly. Right? So, I mean, like, where does that come from? It's, I mean, I don't think it's like one got slapped on the left side and the other on the right side. And then, I mean, come on. From a Buddhist perspective, well, we have tendencies we already bring with us. Yeah? Which, of course, also explains these incredibly bright children. Parents, kind of ordinary, and the child, wow. So there's certain tendencies that we bring along. Also the genetic material we have. But why did we get that genetic material? Why not that? Why that? It's not said to be a coincidence. Yeah. So there I'm thinking, yeah, there's some people who've practiced kindness and compassion. So this in a previous life. So if we are that kind of person, I'm not, but okay. Then that's an advantage. Yeah, in the future, exactly. I can do it now and it helps me in the future. Of course, that's a good point, Ben. Okay, strength of application. Even if one did not meditate on bodhicitta in previous lives, aspiring to attain enlightenment in dependence on putting into practice the Mahayana teachings, one received by a spiritual teacher. So, you know, if you have the fortune to listen to someone who really has bodhicitta, like His Holiness, like these great lamas, then we can be greatly inspired. Again, it's very similar to some of the former points. But here it's more specific. It's not being inspired by their presence, but inspired by what they tell us, the words that they speak, and because they have bodhicitta themselves, then it affects us differently. Okay, so the various ways in which these causes and conditions and strength are practiced. Now, you may think, okay, this is so random. What are these four causes? I have much better causes and conditions. I can bring up much better. So this needs to be put into perspective. Who taught this? Well, a Sangha did in his Bodhisattva Bhumi. To whom did he teach it directly? Well, he had a bunch of people there probably, you know, people at that time who found that extremely helpful. Okay? So many of the teachings are like that. We need to, even when the Buddha was around, those were the people he taught this. So if we understand that, if we're aware of that, we can take the bits and pieces we find helpful and add things. Yeah, it's not about, oh, it's just that and nothing more. It's all about creativity. Like Leora just did. She gave an explanation, an extra explanation to it, right? So that can be added. And I'm sure, and I'm now you're kind of coming out. Now you're coming out. You're saying more things, more input. Initially you didn't, and of course you were overwhelmed. Sorry. So now more things are coming out. You're bringing in your own ideas, and it's all about being creative. These are just kind of guidelines, yeah? And we need to add more things, and you find things, you know, causes and conditions that you can come up with. If I ask you as an assignment, think of other causes and conditions. I'm sure each one of you has a great idea out of your personal experience. Yeah. So these are just guidelines, and you work with those and see what is which works for you. Which causes and conditions do I need to work on? And are there other ones? Because if you understand the whole framework better, that's why I'm trying to put out the whole framework. You understand the point of it. And the techniques, you can develop your own technique. Does that make sense? Now understand what the goal is, and then you come up with your own methods. Okay. And of course, Israel is a country coming out of the desert. I mean, people have to be creative. There's a lot of creativity in this country. And I'm not trying to flatter you. I'm just trying to say as it is. So people here are creative. They have good ideas. Yeah. Had to have because of when Israel started, there was nothing there. I think there's a lot of... Yeah, there is a lot of invention and so forth. And with the Dharma, too. A lot of great authors of Buddhist texts who come from the Jewish background, and they needed to be, it's just in the culture to be creative, to be able to survive. And so therefore they come up with these beautiful books that are very relevant in the 21st century. This is ancient material. Yeah. But, and you said it beautifully, it's ancient material. But the thing is, we should not ignore it, but translate it into the 21st century. To not, I mean, this is the source. We should not let go of the source, but just make it relevant. Okay. All right. So now the two principal causes. Now this is my favorite. This is really day-to-day kind of. Okay. And now I'm going to talk about a little bit. Okay, so those are the two causes, but of course we have to start with ourselves. This is important. It's not included here. Why not? Because the teachings on bodhicitta assume, usually they're preceded by an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And when you understand the Four Noble Truths, that's where you're just doing exactly that. Okay? Who doesn't know about the Four Noble Truths? Okay, everyone does. So, the Four Noble Truths. No. Oh, sorry. You didn't raise your hand. Okay. Then I talk about them not as in like the Four Noble Truths. I will not call them such. But I will talk a little bit about the preparation for all this. Okay. I say I want sentient beings to be free from suffering. But what does that actually mean? What does it mean? Anyone? Those who know about the Four Truths. Which suffering? Okay, she's more precise. The suffering of suffering? Just the suffering of suffering? No. What's the suffering of suffering? What we identify as suffering. What we identify in our everyday life as suffering. Right. Yeah. I want myself to be free from that. Right? We say the wish to be free from suffering is renunciation. Do I have renunciation? No. Everyone wants to be free from suffering. So here, the suffering means something very specific. What is renunciation? Oh, the wish to be free from suffering. But here the suffering doesn't just mean the day-to-day kind of suffering. It means something very specific. There are three types of suffering. So it means the ordinary problems and difficulties, but we all want to be free from them naturally. But understanding that our happiness right now, the happiness we experience in everyday life, that is limited. It is not lasting. In fact, whenever, if we have an object that gives us happiness, anything, you know, the object may be hummus, the object may be a friend, the object may be a movie. If that was really in the nature of suffering, experiencing that object, then the more we did it, the greater the happiness. But usually, you know, we start, and then that suffering, that happiness turns into suffering. With a friend. I can't be with a friend all the time. I cannot watch movies all the time. I need to change the object frequently because there's no lasting happiness to be found in those objects. So happiness can be, lasting happiness can only be found within. So the other objects can provide us some happiness and it's fine to enjoy them. Let's enjoy them. But let's not have unrealistic expectations that they can give us lasting happiness. So the kind of happiness we experience right now is limited. So to want to be free, to the wish to be free from that happiness, which is actually also in the nature of suffering, because it doesn't last. So that is also part of the wish to be free from suffering. It's the wish to be free from the actual suffering, free from the limited happiness we have right now, and to be free from this limited body and mind we have right now. Okay? At least the mind, our mind right now, not to be get rid of our mind in general. We need a mind. The mind will always continue. But to get rid of our anger, afflictions, all the negativities, all that that keeps us trapped in problems, difficulties. To really wish to overcome that, right? And replace it by a mind that is free from that and is full of love and compassion. That is renunciation. But honestly, I'm terribly attached to my little happiness every day. I'm attached to the happiness I get. I am. So it takes time to really understand its shortcoming and understand there's something greater. So it's not easy to develop that wish to overcome the wish to experience pleasure and gain and fame and praise. Yeah, it's very difficult and it takes time. But by again and again seeing the shortcomings of depending on that, one can then slowly develop the wish, I don't want this, I want more. And when you can do that, then you can wish others the same. If you want this for yourself, if you see yourself there's some limitation, you don't wish this for others. You wish for others to be free from that limitation too. But otherwise, what do we mean with enlightenment? I would never want to be enlightened. What does that mean? That means really to want them to be free from the limited happiness. Well, if I don't want to be free from my limited happiness, why would I wish this onto someone else? Yeah. So that's why we have to start with the self. That's why the Theravada or the Hinayana, they're the foundation. Without those, and we said this initially, without the practices that are common to the Hinayana, I cannot develop great compassion. Without great compassion, I cannot. Yeah. So now, before it was just words. I just bombarded you with words. But it's there on a different page before. Yeah. So Sam, I'm just providing you this incredible bulk of material, and hopefully, slowly, things fall into place. Yes. Yes, very good. That was similar to your question yesterday, like this wish or, well, oh no, yours was different. Yours was altruism. How can it turn into attachment? Your question is like, yeah, your question is, isn't that wish a form of attachment, in other words? Just that. Right, and then if you don't get it, you get dissatisfied, you worry. Mm-hmm. But that's why wisdom needs to come in here. You see, it's a wish, but it's not that grasping, clinging. It's like, based on wisdom, is it possible? Well, right now, difficult, but I'm developing. It's not like this obsessiveness, yeah, like clinging and grasping. It's more like, I wish this. It would be nice if I had that. I'm trying to bring the causes and conditions together to make this happen. But it's not an obsessive kind of. You see, just having a wish, there's nothing wrong with that. Even the wish to be happy and not to suffer. That's not to say something, it's not seen as something wrong. It's just an instinctive wish. But when it becomes obsessive, and when I sacrifice others' happiness to get it myself, that's where it becomes a problem. See what I'm saying? There are differences. I can wish my children to be happy. That's love. Right? But I can wish my children to be great ballet dancers, because I would like to be one, right? So then I'm like, I'm actually wanting them to be happy, but it's like, then we have to investigate deeper. So there is the initial wish for them to be happy, but then it's overlaid by all sorts of expectations, because I would like to do that. So we need to be very honest with ourselves and separate those two. And it's easy for them to get mixed, but there's nothing wrong with just the wish itself. If it's calm, and based on wisdom, and based on intelligence, yeah, and based on the sincere wish to benefit others, you see, like the sincere concern for others, then I think it's all right. And of course, it'll be limited. We have a limited mind, so whatever we do is limited. But it's fine to be limited, right? With our limitation, we're trying to move in the right direction. I'm thinking of it like, you know, your goal is to be this great exerciser one day. But right now, we have a limited body, we can only do limited exercise. But that's okay. With the limited body we have right now, that is maybe sick at this point, we work with this, and it's never the perfect exercise that you would do when you have a healthy body. But you still go ahead, because it allows you to slowly cure the body. So these exercises, we do them, and they're not the perfect state. I give you one example. Someone said this to me once, and it was kind of interesting. It's so true, and that got me thinking. Someone says, what is all this talk about altruism? You know, Buddhism talks about altruism here, altruism there, and then it talks about karma. And what about altruism? It tells you if you do something good, you get happiness back. Where is that altruism? It gives you a promise of happiness. Come on! That's contradictory. It's not. It's not contradictory. Because when we start off, the self-grasp, self-cherishing mind is very strong. Let's not underestimate it. Let's not ignore it. Let's work with it. Let's work with the self-cherishing mind. We usually work against it. We are selfish foolishly. Right? We want happiness. We grasp onto happiness. And then what do? We create the causes for unhappiness. So, if we have a strong self-centered attitude, I do, very strong. So I need to be careful with that mind. I cannot suppress it. If I suppress it, it gets stronger. So I work with it. It wants to be happy. It wants certain things. Well, if I want those things, I need to create the causes for that. But slowly, the idea is that the self-grasping mind eventually will overcome the self-grasping mind. There's a saying, Nagarjuna says, that the self-grasping mind will pierce like a spear. It will pierce the self-grasping mind. In other words, you give in to the self-grasping mind, but in a wise way. And slowly, that self-grasping mind loses its grip. It becomes weaker. And then through intelligence, we understand that the object of the self-grasping mind actually never existed. And then, someone tells you, if you're kind and compassionate, you will be happier. You say, I don't care. Whatever. I'm happy. I go to hell, even if I suffer now, as a result of helping others. It's okay. Then it changes. So initially, we need to work very closely with not ignore it, and then it will become weaker. And as it grows weaker, the reward is not important anymore. You get a positive result, it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah? But let's start where we are. I need my reward. I know. I have to be realistic. I would like to be very advanced. I'm just not. Right? No need to pretend. Do I like to do these advanced practices? Yes, I do, but knowing I'm not qualified for them, right? I think of bodhicitta. I like it. I try to do the meditations sometimes, equalizing, exchanging self for others. But I know I'm not there yet, right? That was Mickey's question. Shouldn't I not wait until I'm ready? No, then I have to wait for a really long time. So I try a little bit already, knowing in the back of my mind I'm not ready for this, but I still do it. So there's a difference. Often we are warned, don't do these advanced practices, right? But that's only for people being under the illusion they are advanced. We have to start where we are. We have to be honest with ourselves. What do I need? What is most effective? How strong is my anger? How strong is my attachment? But it doesn't mean we cannot look into the more advanced practices. You know, still. It's a bit like you're in high school, but you take a few university courses. Knowing you're not ready to go there, but you prepare your mind already. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, like Lenora is just saying. And it's also important to develop, to not get to a state where it's kind of like, yeah, very true. Like, to always make sure we enjoy what we're doing, we experience some joy. Because effort or enthusiasm, the word for effort is actually joyous effort. Or the way it's defined, it's like a joyous kind of enthusiasm, feeling enthusiastic about it. So to do the practices that make us feel good, that's also important. Very good point. Yeah, to do practices that make us feel good. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that because that keeps us going. Is that exactly what you meant? Yeah. Okay, great. All right. So having said that, renunciation, the wish for ourselves to be free from the limitations we experience right now. Having done that, we want to do this towards others. Okay? So, there are two principal techniques or causes for generating bodhicitta. The other different causes and conditions, they're helpful, but they're only really effective with those two here. So, these two are usually explained separately, but are combined in practice. In other words, you practice both. Not simultaneously, but one day you practice one you practice the other. Okay, I will teach. Okay, so the first one is the Sevenfold Cause and Effect Method and equalizing and exchanging self for others. Which one do you think is more popular in the West? Definitely the second. Which is why, for a while, I didn't stress the first one so much. And then I thought, no, there is some resistance to the first one. Let's work with that resistance. Two factors that we have a resistance towards, but we'll come to that. Okay. That's why I tried to now stress the first one a little bit more. But let's see. The Sevenfold Cause and Effect Method originated with Buddha Shakyamuni. Okay, he himself taught it. And has come down to us from Maitreya, Asanga, Chandrakirti, Chandragomin, Kamalashila, and so forth. Just knowing this is nice. You know, this was passed down by these great masters. We know the names. We may pay attention to the texts when we come across them. And they have a lot to offer. They were incredible masters. So they were actually pastors. Shakyamuni passed those down. So when we say we pass down, means pass it down to Maitreya. Maitreya gained realizations, and then through his deep realization experience, he passed that on. And there was an unbroken lineage. But it was passed down separately at some point in the past. Okay. And then there's the other lineage. Shakyamuni Buddha has got, the other lineage came down from Manjushri. So Maitreya was one of the Buddha's disciples. He was one of Buddha's disciples. And Manjushri was too. So he passed those lineages on separately. So Manjushri, Nagarjuna, Shantideva, and so forth. The Indonesian master Selingpa held both traditions. He had received both lineages. I mean, the experiential kind of explanations, he received both, and passed them on to his disciple Atisha, who disseminated them in a combined form in Tibet. So Atisha, of course, went to Tibet in the 12th century and brought the Lamrim teachings to Tibet. So he received both traditions together from his master Selingpa, who was in Indonesia, who lived in Indonesia. However, before practitioners engage in meditating on any of the two techniques, they must train in equanimity. So equanimity is very important. It's the prerequisite for the practice of any of the three vehicles, and therefore it's not mentioned separately in the technique, those two techniques, because it's important all the time. Okay, which takes us to this fact that it's very difficult to generate love and compassion for all sentient beings if we are biased. And we are. Let's be honest. We are biased. Okay? All right. So we are. Some are less, some are more. But in general, I think we're pretty biased. So we it's easy to have compassion towards those we like. It's a little harder to have compassion towards we don't know. But it's really difficult to have compassion towards those we don't like. Very difficult, just natural. So first you get more of an equilibrium. Right, I mean, it sounds hard, but there are techniques. I mean, let's try the techniques, and then if the mind changes, then great. Yeah. We did the meditation yesterday. Did you find that helpful? Was the meditation helpful yesterday? Do you think of the three people? Yeah, so if you found that helpful, but of course doing it just once. No. Familiarization with that. So if you're interested, you could do that meditation every now and then and go through the steps. I mean, today I will do a different meditation with you, but this would give you some sense of what that would entail. So the reasonings are right here. You can also look at the book How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald, because there you have all the steps very beautifully laid out. It's quite easy to. There are many different meditations that are helpful in this context here. Pardon? It's called How to Meditate. There are many books called that. So, How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald. And I think it's also her, the name Robina Corton is also there when you Google it. She added something to it. Robina Corton, like this last edition, she added some parts. So, she's also now part of the authors, Robina Corton. But it's actually Kathleen McDonald. Sangye Khatro, she's been to Israel. Her Tibetan name is Sangye Khatro. She visited Israel on numerous occasions, I think. So her American name is Kathleen McDonald. Like McDonald's, except not the S. And then Kathleen. Kathleen McDonald. And if you go to Amazon and you Google it, you go to the search engine of Amazon, 100% you find it. There's a Kindle version available. So if you're interested in analytical meditations, that would be a very good book to get. It's beautifully explained what you need to do initially, and then the meditations are described. Okay. And the equanimity meditation is there, yes, please. Of course. Yes, you're right. Yes, you're absolutely right. You see, the first one that was passed on through Maitreya, Asanga, Chandrakirti, Chandragoman, and Kamalashila, of course, Chandrakirti is also someone who is wisdom, but it is more based on something, it's more emotionally based, let's put it that way. Whereas the other one, Manjushri, Nagarjuna, Shantideva, is more based on wisdom in the sense of like, even taking the ultimate nature of phenomena, all sentient beings are equal, they lack inherent existence. So there's more that aspect of rationalism in there, which doesn't mean, it's just more of an emphasis on it. But in both cases, it's emotional, and in both cases, if you had to compare the two, but of course it's rational reasoning, it comes into both. It's a little hard. I mean, it's very hard to say. You can argue both ways. You could say, oh, there's also a lot of rational thinking in the first tradition. Yeah. But actually, we associate, of course, Maitreya more with the method and Manjushri more with the wisdom. I'm just not sure whether this is really exactly the case here, because the method teachings and the wisdom teachings, that's a whole different matter. They were also passed on to Maitreya, the method, but this is a different lineage altogether. But it has been explained sometimes a little bit more like equalizing, exchanging self for others. That has, like, because emptiness comes in there. You say that sentient beings are equal because they all lack intrinsic existence. That reasoning comes in there. The reasoning of emptiness does not come into the first one as much, or not at all, actually. Anyway, you'll see. So, what is actually the state of mind? Can we stop it? Can we stop judging people? No, very difficult. Initially, we do. I mean, I'm like, I exaggerate when I say this, but it's really like we are with a group of people and we go, like, dislike, don't care, like, dislike, don't care, like, dislike. We do this in our mind right away, judging people very quickly. Oh, this person, similar haircut, my style of clothes, like, right? Or something we have in common. We see things that we have in common with them and feel close to them. Or there's a certain behavior we may admire in someone. We observe this for a few seconds already. We're like, oh, we don't know. That's why we're often wrong. The person we initially don't like, a week later we're best friends. Yeah? Or the person we initially thought was really obnoxious. The person we initially liked a lot becomes a stranger. Right? And after, like when you're with a group, the people you bond with initially, it changes quickly. Yeah? So the thing is, to judge right away, we can't help that. But we can choose to follow that judgment or not. We can say, okay, wait a minute, okay, I'm looking at this person, but I should remind myself, is that really in accordance with reality? What am I basing my reason on? Is it not very superficial? Yeah. Does that make sense? So it's like it constitutes a state of mind that feels it is pointless to generate prejudice towards others. It doesn't mean we still do it. We do it automatically, but we can choose to follow up on it or feel, no, this is pointless. This does not make sense. So to discriminate between friend, enemy, or agreeable and disagreeable, and to act under the sway of attachment and anger. Yeah, so even the group of people now in every everyday life, the people we feel close to, the ones we dislike, and the ones we don't care about, it seems so fixed. It seems so unchanging, but actually isn't. We check further. So, yeah. Okay, good question. Her question is, the purpose of this, is this to like everyone, to dislike everyone, or to feel neutral about them? None of the three. I mean, I think it's like kind of like an openness. It's a kind of openness. Like, okay, maybe I become strangers, maybe I will like them, maybe, but let's just keep that possibility open. Kind of like I'm not going to judge right away. Like I don't care, let's just be open and see that they're all the same. They don't want to suffer, they want to be happy, just like me. And then the next step is actually to get close. You feel close to them. Of course, we don't keep the gap for like a good time. Oh, let's just be all neutral all the time. You become like some kind of robot. That's not the idea. Of course, it's just to, for a short time, just have that sense. Let's see. And then replace it with care and love. Yeah. But without some, it's a bit like you have to remove the stones in the field. And you very quickly plant the seeds. But you need to remove the big rocks. Yeah. Stumble blocks. Okay, so, but let's do the reasoning then. How do we get there? We need to use reasoning. Without reasoning, we cannot change our mind. This is something I've not mentioned here, but I said this on during many times when I teach. This is the last thing I say before we have a break. A lot of the times when I teach, I say this. Reasoning, and in Israel, this is not a problem. In other places, it's more of a problem. People think meditation, all this reasoning, what is this? I mean, meditation is about stilling the mind, you know, getting the mind to stop thinking. Yeah. So people think that that's meditation. Yes, there are those types of meditation where you just focus on one object. That is called stabilizing meditation, and that is very necessary. But that's just one type. We also need the analytical meditation, because otherwise the mind doesn't change. A little bit it changes through just observing and being mindful, but we also have to make conscious changes. We have to change our emotions. How do we change the emotions? Through reasoning. Do we do this in everyday life? Of course we do. Anger is an emotion, a destructive emotion. Does it arise without any reason? No. There's always a reason. Such and such said, I suck. That's a reason. Such and such, I did such good things for them, and how? Look how they repay me. Another reason. We it's not like someone says something, we get angry right away. We reflect on what they said. What did he just say to me? He said such and such. How dare he? What did he say to me? I didn't deserve this. I worked really hard. Da, da, da. These are all reasons. I'm not saying they're all correct reasons. Incorrect reasons are still reasons. But all these reasons, you know, they could have said it to this other person. I really did this. Da, 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 da. And then after we think about it, then it goes deeper and anger arises. It's a meditation on anger. It's really on anger, literally. First, we reason, then a feeling arises, you know. First, there's not even a feeling of displeasure. We hear the words, we register, and we're still kind of like, Right? There's like this slow, because the mind starts do, you know, very quickly, much faster than any movie. And then slow, you know, more and more and more and more. It's the reasoning that precedes that. That's our psychological makeup. That's how our mind works. So reasoning, and then you get to some kind of conclusion and an emotion arises. I did the same with you yesterday. Reasoning, conclusion, focus on the conclusion. Make it sink in. Yeah? That's what we do with anger. We make it sink in. And then we carry that cloud of what this person said. Right, huge emotion. It's like these words. It's like this dark cloud we carry with us. Right, the words are long gone. They're just words. Yeah, so our mind makes something with them. So that's the power of the mind. But in this way, of course, we use it in a destructive way. Right? I mean, this cloud of suffering. Right? It's like what we make with it. We make our own story in our mind. Often has nothing to do with reality. Maybe they didn't even talk to us. You know, whatever. I mean, we all have our funny stories where we, in the end, we're like, oh my God, I was unhappy the whole day yesterday. I totally misunderstood. Anyway, but that's why I'm trying to stress this idea of reasoning. That's why I use the reasonings here. Because we use the reasoning and bring it to an emotional level. And we can only make changes when we do this. And I read an interesting article about how the prefrontal cortex and the limbic systems, that's what they're called, the kind of root brain, there's really that connection that we can, this is like the emotional part of the brain is the back part, is that root brain. And the prefrontal cortex, that's where the reasoning takes place. And because they're so closely connected, these two communicate. Yeah. So I can use reasonings to then bring forth certain emotions. So I use reasoning to bring forth the emotion of equanimity. It's an emotional state of not reacting. It's not a wisdom as such. We would say it's like an emotional state. Or love, compassion. They're even more emotional states. So I use the reasoning, the prefrontal cortex, basically, to then generate love, compassion. Whereas usually I use the prefrontal cortex to reflect on these words and then have anger. Yeah. So it's the same mechanism, but this time I use reasons that are in accordance with reality. Yes. After the break? Yeah. Okay. So 20 minutes break. It's 25 now, almost. Never mind, 25. So 10:45, let's get together again at 10:45.